morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet FM 104.6. Shalom, Rabbi Altshul.
Shalom uvracha, John.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome back Rabbi Altshul, and we're going to continue talking about the Jewish life cycle and the excitement when it comes up to the time of the wedding. And I'm just asking the rabbi, do we believe that marriages are made in heaven?
Well, Joan, it depends on from which side of the wedding contract you're looking. No, it's our firm belief that God has his shlichim, his emissaries, angels, that he gets to do most tasks. But there are two tasks which the Gemara tells us that God looks after himself, and that is distributing water to the world, and it is finding matches. Sometimes they use human instruments, you know, matchmakers and that kind of thing.
So yeah. That's where the shatchan fits in.
That's where the shatchan fits in. But no, generally it's thought that God looks after finding your bashert, your the one and only.
Your significant other.
Significant other, absolutely.
And what if things go wrong? Who do you blame?
Well, it's always
the angel made a mistake.
No, as I said, it's not the angels who makes the matches. It's the God himself who makes the matches, that we firmly believe. Who's to blame? Well, I think a lot of people, when it comes to marriage, looks as it's, you know, very often when young people get into it, they're intoxicated by infatuation and other things, and they don't really realize that a good marriage is hard work. And it's a give and take. It's one where you have to give everything of yourself and not expect to be taking too much out, but contributing to the unit that it is, and when a family comes about. And it's hard work. You know, you can't just go on the happy feeling of being in love and being infatuated, and gosh, she's beautiful, and wow, he's dapper, handsome. You know, there's much more to marriage. Marriage is quite an art, and I think often when it goes wrong, it's because we're neglecting it. There are so many things taking our attention in the world, and then sometimes it's just, you know, accidents happen, even, you know, and we learn something from that.
But if you're both contributing, but when one contributes more than the other, then it's imbalance.
But Joan, everybody, how do you weigh those things, right? Do you take out a measuring stick and start saying, I gave 30 centimetres, now you give 30 centimetres? What if the other party has only 28 centimetres to give in this, or let's say in kilos and grams? We can't quantify. But we have to say that it's a lot about emotions and how people perceive it and feel it. And I think this is one of the important things of marriage. Like with all human relations, it's communications. You've got a talk about it. Don't let the sun go down on your problems. Don't let it set. Talk about it. Don't be angry or anything else because you receive some criticism. Criticism is very often a way that can help you grow and to become stronger in a relationship together, not as separate entities. But you're right, there are discrepancies. We won't make perfect. I'm sorry. We bring our imperfections with us into marriage. The intent from God's side might be good, but we bring our imperfections with us, and that might be what sometimes mucks up the whole picture.
I think if both parties wanted to succeed and they're willing to do a give and take, you rub along quite happily. But if sometimes relationships break down just because somebody is not willing or wants control over the other one, then it's more difficult.
You're right. It is, but that's why relationships are so difficult. It's not easy. You know, the perfect marriage probably doesn't exist, but you can work on it, and it's a lifetime achievement.
It is a lifetime achievement.
It is. That's it. That's
so if you remain with one husband. I was talking to a group of people and everybody had two or three husbands. You know,
oh, dear.
Only had one.
Well, I'm not going to be facetious, but I guess that says more about them than it says about you, Joan.
Okay, so marriage is made in heaven, but because we have free will and because we're human, mistakes happen.
Yeah.
And, okay, so when a couple decide, and I think in a Jewish marriage, it's not just the couple who are married. The families get involved willy-nilly.
Yes, I mean, such a thing. Jewish shotguns weddings are really, really rare. The kids run away and elope and get married also is also quite rare. You know, Jewish weddings, they take a bit of preparation. I certainly encourage people to come and have some counselling before they go into it. That I demand as a part of the whole marriage preparation, so that they're aware, so that you address some of the issues that they might not have thought about. It depends on who they are, where they are, but you sit down and talk to them.
So is this part of something you offer?
Yes, absolutely.
Come to you to say they want to get married, you say, listen, my children, sit down and out.
Exactly. Maybe not in that way, but, you know, I say, we need some chatting. And that's normal.
Effective conversations.
Absolutely. But obviously the young couple has to decide for a date. In previous times you would have things such as betrothal, which took place years before the marriage or a year before, and they were technically as married. We still do it in some communities, not in all communities.
What?
A betrothal. Yeah. Engagement.
Right.
Yes. Engagement. And that's done in some parties, in some communities, but not in all. And it's not so customary. The more observant people are generally, they more tend to observe those things. Yesteryear, bride and groom didn't live together before they got married. They started living together after the chuppah.
In fact, you didn't leave home.
Well, probably not, unless you had a job. But so that has changed a little bit. Mm. You know, in many religious communities, people still don't live together, and they meet either through friends or through a shadchan, you know, like a matchmaker. They go out for a cup of coffee, two cups of coffee, three cups of coffee, and by the fourth cup of coffee, normally either you know that it's a dud or you know that this is a go, and then they embark on the journey.
At what stage do they approach you?
Oh, that can be any given stage during the whole course of wedding preparations. I mean, one would hope that they would secure that the rabbi is available to do the ritual and help them through it so that they would give me at least a couple of days' warning. Generally, I know 6 months in advance, or 2 months in advance.
So do rabbis automatically be sanctioned to perform marriages in legal way for the whichever country they're in?
Not at all. You have to apply for that. You have to be a what's called a religious marriage celebrant in New Zealand.
So you have to be registered.
You have to be.
Do registered. They give you a test or something?
No, they don't. They generally allow us to conduct the wedding ceremony according to our traditions and faith, and then on the side we do the New Zealand statutory wedding ceremony. Well, it's not really a ceremony, but you ask whether so-and-so will take so-and-so. There's a whole dialogue which is written down and which you have to do. And some people want it as part of their Jewish wedding ritual, and others prefer to do it in the office beforehand. Because technically what goes on is a bit of paper signing, marriage certificates and things, and that needs to be done beforehand. So that's one of the technicalities.
So they're actually married legally before they come to be married spiritually.
Well,
or it can be.
That's a discussion, because according to Jewish law, a civil marriage contract is null and void. I mean, that's we do because we honour New Zealand law.
Right.
It's not a necessity from our point of view, but the second that the ketubah has been signed by the two witnesses, which we'll get to in a moment, I hope. then the groom is married and the bride when she accepts the ring. So that's sort of the story. You have to understand that a Jewish wedding, Jewish marriage, is a legal contract. It's not a spiritual contract. It's a legal contract.
Is that the ketubah?
Jewish marriage is a legal function. It's not in the way that... It's not per se. We ask for God's blessings also, but per se, the ketubah is certainly a very, very legal document.
So perhaps you could explain about...
All right, so let's take
it from the beginning. When does that come in?
Well, generally, the way, you know, many communities have many different customs, but generally, bride and groom should not see each other the week before the wedding. It's also tradition in many communities that somebody accompany the bride and the groom during the week leading up to their wedding, helping them with all their chores, because bride and groom are like king and queen. And a king and a queen, they always have a boy or a lady in waiting. And therefore, it's also our tradition to honour them in the same way that a king and queen is honoured. As, you know, we help them with everything they need help with and carry their bags on the street and this and that. So that's a beautiful custom. Now, on the wedding day itself, it's tradition to fast because... bride and groom are considering starting a whole new life when they unify under the chuppah. And as nobody should have to atone for anybody else's sins, it's counted as a personal Yom Kippur. And therefore, very often, bride and groom do not eat. That's also why they very often dress in white. The groom in the kittel that is worn normally only for Yemei Noraim, for the high holidays, and all of that. They'll arrive at the shul. In some communities, it's popular that the chassan has a tish beforehand. That means that people can come and, you know, congratulate, and he gives a little word of Torah and maybe pours out a little bit of whiskey for everybody coming, and they can say, L'chaim, of course, he's not imbibing anything at this time because he's fasting. Then comes the signing of the ketubah. Now, what's a ketubah? Ketubah is basically a document conceived in Aramaic. It's around 2100 years old, in which it states that the groom so-and-so takes the bride so-and-so for a specific dowry, and he promises that he will look after her in all possible ways, i.e. he will put clothes on her body, food on her table, roof over her head. It even states that he has to satisfy her in the familiar way. Now, this is a 2,100-year-old contract. It says that he has to make her happy, not only when she's at the table, but also when she's in the bedroom. That's very interesting that they conceive that. But the whole Gemara has a whole thing. For example, if a man is a camel trader or he goes with the caravans, how often does he have to have conjugal visits with his wife and so forth, and how much can she demand from him to perform? So that's a two-way street. You know, a man cannot deny his wife conjugal rights, neither can a woman deny her husband, as long as they live according to the family purity laws. Now, of course, previous to the signing of the contract, we'll have all these discussions. The bride will have gone to the mikvah to purify herself. The groom will sometimes also go to the mikveh, to the ritual bath, to purify himself in the morning before. That's a very beautiful way, sort of saying, this is a new beginning and we start all over. The ketubah is not signed by the groom himself. Poor man. The ketubah is read out to him and translated into any language that he may speak or understand. And when he recognizes that, he understands that, he gives a sign by lifting up something. The rabbi very often gives him a handkerchief. I always run around with handkerchiefs, you know. Lift up the handkerchief to show that you've understood. Lift it up over your shoulders. And he does. And then there has to be two witnesses. And the witnesses sign on the groom's behalf. Now, they are the guarantors that the said groom will be able to perform as according to the contract. That ends the whole deal for the groom. He has basically, his deed is signed, he has recognized to take upon himself the obligations which are stipulated in the contract, the ketubah, and it's now done for him. Now, what then happens is that he will take his place under the chuppah, or he will walk in while being sung in, sing a hymn, Baruch Haba, or Mi'edir al Hakol, beautiful songs. He walks up, stands on the chuppah, and then, of course, the bride joins the company. But just before all of this is what is called the Bedeken. Do you remember the story of Jacob and Laban?
Mm-hmm.
So Laban had two daughters, and Jacob loved the younger one. But he got cheated on the wedding night and got the senior one. And because of that, we say that the groom is entitled to cover his bride so that he's sure that whoever's under the cover, the deacon, is the right bride.
So the veil has to be lifted.
He veils her. She is obviously sits somewhere just close to the chuppah, and he will put the veil over her, and then he'll proceed going in, and then she'll join after him. And she will be sung in as well. Now, there are many traditions about encircling. There are some communities that do it, some communities that don't. Mm-hmm. Some communities do it three times, some communities do it seven times. The encircling is just like the circling of the moon around the earth or anything else. But it symbolizes the creation of a new universe, of a new world.
The groom told my niece that it was like a lion circling her prey.
Poor man. Good one. And therefore, there are many reasons to these things. There are a lot of things. There are written whole books about rituals and their origins. Some explanations are beautiful, some are not so good, and so forth. But it's the seven rounds are to symbolize the seven days of creation.
So what is the chuppah and the canopy?
So the chuppah, which is over, which can be made out of basically anything. You know, a piece of cloth. Very often a talit will be used, extended on four poles. Other places, they have illustrious chuppah that are beautiful with embroidery and everything else. The chuppah symbolizes the new home. But just as the tent of Avraham Avinu, of Abraham, it is open on all four sides. As a Jewish home should be, it should be open to the strangers, to the needy, to all those who are looking for shelter. Exactly. And that is what we wish for them. We wish that they're building. So symbolically, they are wishing, or they're building a new home. Under the chuppah first, we have the Misader Kiddushin is very often the rabbi. But a Misader Kiddushin, the person who conducts the ceremony, can basically be any observant Jew over the age of 13. He should have some knowledge of the laws, because there are quite a few mistakes you can make during a wedding ceremony. And of course, there are written pages after pages after pages in the Shulchan Aruch and other books about what to do and what not to do, what to say and what not to say. First, we have the sanctifications, and the first cup is served to them. Boy, Boy, Geffen, they are bride and groom are blessed, and we say the special bracha, and then the groom presents the bride with the ring. Now, what's in the ring ceremony? The ring has to be preferably smooth and round, so that it will be symbolical of a smooth and round life. Not referring to the beginning of our conversation. But it's our wish that it should be. And only the groom gives the bride a ring, because that is really part of the dowry. The value of the ring, it has to be a valuable ring, but the value is set at one pruta. How much is one pruta? Pruta is the price of a washer in Bunnings. You know, simple. So, you know, he can get away with it pretty easily. Mm. But still, the ring is held up and presented to the two witnesses. And they can say, yep, it's a nice ring. You know, it looks like it's worth a pruta. It will be acceptable. And he gives it to her, and he puts it on her right index finger. No, yeah, index, right?
Right.
Yes. And she will hold on to it for the rest of the ceremony. In some communities, the custom is to move it from the index finger and put it on the ring finger as the bride's acceptance of the marriage. But from when she takes this, the ring, she's in it as well.
Right.
And then he says the famous words, "Behold, with this ring I sanctify you to me according to the laws of Moses and Israel." And that is basically the part. But then we need to publicize the contract. So this is the time where the Ketubah will read. Very often a rabbi will speak. And then after that we have what is known as the Sheva Brachot. Sheva is seven blessings said over bride and groom. These can be said either by the Mesoteh Kiddushin, the officiating person, or it can be said by seven different people that are connected. But again, it should preferably be said by somebody who is observant. And that really ends it all. And then we have some additional, something that people always remember. What about the crushing of the glass?
Yes.
We have to remember, there is a verse which says that if I do not put Jerusalem over all my joy, the whole verse goes, if I forget you, Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its cunning. If I do not put you, let my tongue cling to the palate. If I do not put you over my highest joy, then let me wither and go away. And the thing is, well, Jerusalem looks pretty beautiful. When I was there in April, it's coming along quite nicely. But still, something is lacking. It's not the Jerusalem of splendor that once was in the kingdom of David. And therefore, we add just that little bit of bitterness in the cup. Even at the top of our joy, we remember that Jerusalem was destroyed. Jerusalem was destroyed because we as human beings couldn't get along. Jerusalem was destroyed for our bad deeds. And we crush the glass and everybody screams Masatov. And hopefully the groom won't get any glass in his foot. That has happened, unfortunately. And then the wedding is not yet over because there is one last thing. Remember, they've been fasting. And after that, they go into what's called the Cheder Chut, the room of unity. This was when, in previous years, very often, the marriage would be consummated, as it's said.
There and then.
There and then, absolutely. No room for anxiety. These days, it most of the time gives the bride and groom just 5 to 10 minutes to sort of get over the ceremony, get a little bit to eat. There's often fruit served, which they haven't eaten, so they can say the special blessing of thank you to God for bringing us to this time. And they'll just get reacquainted with each other before they face the crowd. Now, this is all based on the Gemara says that there are three ways of getting married. Either by contract, the Ketubah, either by money, the ring, or by going into a room alone and having two witnesses. So outside the Cheder Yichud, there are two officers standing guard. They're the witnesses that they're alone in there. And in the modern Jewish wedding ritual, we combine all three of them. It used to be that either one of these would qualify. But just to make sure, we put them all three together in one ritual. And that's the ritual that we conduct today. And that's a beautiful thing. And then, of course, they face the crowd. And that's when the dancing begins, eh?
And when they sit on the chairs and hold a handkerchief and the
people, sitting
luckily, if they're not very big, their friends can lift them up in their chairs.
No, but just think back to what I said at the beginning about having a valet, somebody walking with you. The whole sitting on chairs and being lifted on chairs. Who gets lifted on chairs?
Right.
Kings and queens.
Right.
Right? They used to be carried around on their chairs because they were, they shouldn't touch the dirt. So the same, that's why we lift up bride and groom as well.
And the holding of the handkerchief?
The holding of the handkerchief is
to show they're linked.
Well, the holding of the handkerchief is basically something about snoot. It's something about modesty that in the more religious circles, you're not supposed to touch in public, man and wife, you know. That's something that's designated for the private realm. And also when dancing with others, that's why you have that cord in between, that you don't really hold hands. But you know, I've seen people hold hands as well.
And we have 5 minutes, Rabbi. So what if things don't work out? How does it end?
Of course, it doesn't end. It should be happily married forever after.
But it happens. So do we have rituals that go with ending a marriage as well?
Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, we're very ritual people.
Somehow I have that in brain.
Yes. Of course, if irreconcilable differences occur, as they do in human lives, and people need to get divorced, then they need to go through the process of getting a get. Now, the get is, again, a document, just like the ketubah, which the husband has to command being written. It has to be written on a piece of paper, but with a quill, using the traditional writing style. So very often he commands a sofer to do it for him. He makes a shliach out of him, an emissary out of him, and then he issues the divorce document, which is then delivered to the wife in a small ceremony. Again, it's all very ceremonial, but it's more private, the gittin. And generally also you try to do counseling before they get that fund, before they issue the get. They need to be agreeing on things, and they aren't always, obviously. Sometimes there's quite a road to travel before you get to that.
Do people actually come to the rabbi and say, look, we're having problems, and are you expected to be a marriage counselor? And if you are, what training do you have to be a marriage counselor?
Well, obviously I'm a marriage counselor, and people do come to me. I mean, on a regular basis. Family counselling, marriage counselling.
Is that part of your training as a rabbi?
Absolutely not. That's training that has come secondary, which I've studied at Monash in Australia. No. Rabbinical studies, at least not orthodox ones, there is not much of that. Will be some, but depending on where you study and how you study.
I think it's a very important part.
Absolutely.
Of human relations.
But the rabbi is the first port of call for a lot of people when they have problems, and then it's for the rabbi to figure out where to send them. So, I definitely know my limitations, and if I see that it's something that's greater than what I can deal with, then I will pass them on to a proper professional, marriage counsellor, for example.
But the idea is to try and retrieve...
You try to do some... see if you can repair it, or if it can be worked on.
Particularly if there's children involved.
Absolutely, but it doesn't matter. A marriage is a marriage. That being said, if that's not well, then we accept that at the end of things you can get married. Oh, sorry, you can get divorced, and it's very important to get a Jewish divorce. Couple are married, and for example, the wife would want to remarry. She can't remarry without a get, if she's been previously married. And that's a problem that some men keep their women, their ex-wives, captives because they don't want to issue them get. Mm. And that is a very, very bad and naughty thing to do. And the rabbis, as a matter of fact, have a quite strong mandate to convince the man, recalcitrant man, to issue the get to the wife so she's set free. If she's not set free, she's what's called a captive wife, an aguna. And that happens, unfortunately, in some cases.
So what are her rights?
Well, basically, her, what do you mean, her rights?
Well, if she doesn't get a divorce,
well, then she can't get married Jewish again. And if she should go on and have any more children, they are considered as the children of an illicit...
Oh, a little bit of unfairness. But nevertheless, I'm sure that it's being remedied.
We try.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Pleasure.
And we will have another session on continuing life cycle. And thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday at 10 past 10. And if you've missed the program on www.planetaudio.org.nz, /Radio Shalom.